Hello, and welcome to the GDUSA podcast, a series of talks with people making design news and shaping the creative community. I'm your host, Gordon Kay, publisher and editor of GDUSA Magazine, now in our 55th year of publication. Each week, I will be speaking with individuals I've come to know and respect for a combination of talent, leadership, success, and community service. For our first episode, I spoke to Scott Starrett, co-founder and creative director of Tandem NYC visual communications firm. When I say the name Scott Starrett, I can sense genuine interest, enthusiasm, and excitement among our readers, because Scott is at the cutting edge of a movement by designers in their 20s and 30s, using their talents to create and shape positive social and political change as they see it. And this interview is especially timely because Scott's firm, Tandem, was instrumental in helping to elect to Congress insurgent New York City Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who officially began her tenure in Congress this past week. Her election and the design that supported it have had a ripple effect throughout the entire country. Here is my conversation with Scott Starrett. So, Scott, could you tell us just a little bit about your personal story, where you were born, where you grew up, when you first became aware of art and design, politics, any or all of the above?
Yeah, absolutely. And stop me if I go on too long. I was born in the Midwest. I grew up in Kansas, in the Kansas City metro area. And I always knew, I believe, that I wanted to move to a more metropolitan area. But I had a lot of really close friends, and I stayed in Kansas to attend the University of Kansas, where I studied graphic design and illustration, visual communications. As a child, from a pretty young age, my mother put crayons and pencils in my hand to busy me. And I think I remember... I think I remember my first design job. The young boys in kindergarten would get together and convene on the matter of what we were going to pretend to be during recess. And it was my job to collectively draw each person's make-believe character, getting instruction from my my 5-year-old friends on what kind of monster they wanted to be that day. I would draw each of us out, and then we would go act it out. I've always drawn. I still draw every day. I think I get a sort of illness comes over me if I don't get to draw or create. And sometimes it takes me a little while being in a more administrative role. I forget that I need to design. I need to create. I need to make and get into that flow state, you know, where the world kind of falls away.
Yeah.
So I studied design and illustration, and then I actually stayed in Kansas in Lawrence, which is kind of a rare thing to have a career in what's a pretty small college town. It's usually about 80,000 people, I believe. And I became a designer at the university. I worked for the Memorial Unions Corporation, which housed several different outlets for the university. And I started designing, doing T-shirts and posters for them. And then I ended up taking on a role as marketing director for the university's bookstore. And then I ended up becoming the director of marketing for that corporation, which is a nonprofit corporation owned by the university. I think that I was the youngest director ever there. I don't know that for sure, but someone told me that once. So I'll take it. I believe I was the youngest director, but that's less exciting than what I got to do there, which was design a department. They didn't have a marketing department head for the entire union. So I actually got to design how everything worked between departments and got to form a student design center, which was a lot of fun. And I got to work with my old professors to, you know, kind of find the cream of the crop and set up a design process so that young students could get real world experience. From Lawrence, I moved to Austin, Texas, where I pushed my way into political communication design and worked for about 4 years there, working on local campaigns in Austin, and then a statewide campaign and some nonprofits and orgs in between.
What was the transition from what sounds like a challenging and sort of groundbreaking job in Lawrence, but not necessarily one that had political implications, to the Austin job?
Well, I think while it was a great experience as a young man, and I am grateful for all the people that trusted me, the world of marketing was fantastic to learn about. But I just didn't see myself there. And so I moved to Austin and knew I needed to get my hands back into the mix, as it were. I needed to start making things again because I was pretty much purely administrative in my role. And while I still think marketing's fascinating, and I do plenty of it, we do plenty of it at Tandem, I'm really much more interested in the craft of design, conceptual design, even theoretical design. But I was falling away from that. And then again, I have this political component, which you also asked me about. And I think I just was looking for a way to force the two together on some level. And, you know, a lot of it's serendipity, a lot of it's happenstance. I feel like I kind of asked the universe. I said that I wanted to work in political design. And then a few weeks later, a friend of mine mentioned that he worked at a political communications firm, and I ended up getting a job there. So the transition was interesting because I went from being in charge in a way, going back to being on staff, but there was just so much to learn. And that was a big part of why I wanted to do it. I wanted to see how campaigns were run. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see how the sausage was made, as it were. I was kind of a strange kid at times. I was an artist. You know, I had long hair in high school and wore torn up jeans, but I also attended youth court as a lawyer and mm-hmm. was the chair of the teen council, which was a real city council for the teens in my city, and was a senator in youth Congress. So I was involved in a kind of what is not generally, you know, stereotypically two dissimilar worlds, I would say.
Yes.
And then oftentimes after school, I'd go home and watch C-SPAN. So I don't know.
It's an addiction.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yes.
I remember as a young child, I used to try to do the accent of John Kennedy because that was our hero.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
politics has a real winner take all. It is zero sum in the end, you know, and there's something about that that's exciting.
Yes. So was the Austin firm, did it have a particular political bent, or did they take clients of all kinds?
No, it was purely progressive liberal. And you know, it's interesting. I never seen a firm that straddles the aisle. And I think it's because it could turn against somebody, right?
Yes.
If you help get someone's opponent elected, working with the enemy, as it will. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wish it weren't like that necessarily.
Yeah.
And especially as objective designers, it gets into interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Or an attempt to be objective. Yeah,
I wondered, that this question should really come later, but in the chronology, but I wondered whether you could ever conceive of yourself of doing what you do for someone who you thought was great, but didn't share necessarily your political views, but you respected personally.
That is an interesting question. And, you know, I think we even have a challenge within the minutia of degrees. We have discussions at Tandem, and I have discussions with other professionals. How progressive can you get? How far left can you get? Will the center still have you if you go too far left? Or will the Democratic Socialists be upset if we work with somebody that's pushing more towards the center? And I don't know that I have a great answer to your question. I have to qualify and say, so far in my career and considering Tandem's potential, what's best for our firm, we talk out each case one by one. So I think there would be repercussions, mm-hmm. but if we were motivated to do so by an individual, if they were the right person, or a lot of the decisions we make, we like the idea of giving people chances that wouldn't have had chances. A lot of people have access to the hot shot consulting firms if they've played their cards right. You know, the career politicians, they stay in a circle and they're become aligned with certain consulting firms. We really like the idea of throwing as much support down ballot to people. Lena Hidalgo, for example, who won Harris County Judge, we didn't publicize it very much along the way, but we also did her identity, and she just won, which is really exciting. And the idea there was not that they had a ton of money and they were going to make our career, but simply it matters so much to a small grassroots campaign to have people that have been through it before, throw them some assistance. And, you know, we kind of straddle that line again of trying to remain objective. Of course, we got to know the Hidalgo campaign and appreciated what they stood for. But in this job, you can only know so much about the people you're working with and working for. And so it's always kind of a risk, right? You're tying yourself to somebody. And so we try to evaluate it from a distance and say, will we feel good about helping that person? It makes us feel better if they maybe couldn't have received that assistance from someone else. Objectively, we can say, you know, we gave them a shot. Yes. To voice their opinion. Mm-hmm. What they say is what they say. Mm-hmm. You know, we are just trying to even the playing field right. A little bit, as it were.
And just to push it a little further, there are only 24 hours in the day, and you probably work 23 of them. But that means there's limited time and resources. So yeah. Are there situations where you have to turn down people who you like to support?
There are, and there are compromises that have to be made as well. We believe in the power of strong communication, strong visual communication, strong branding, even into the messaging. We help folks craft messages and write copy. We have to be realistic at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, resources are finite. Our time is finite. You could pour all of your heart and soul into any one campaign. Right. So we're just constantly managing that idea of how to do the most good and how to push this, you know, what's kind of an emerging idea of activism and advocacy and engagement. It's also really important for us to get the word out about design's involvement in those causes.
Yes.
We tend to say yes to most talks or interviews, no matter how small, because we're just so grateful that this conversation's happening.
Yes.
It's something I've personally advocated for years. Mm-hmm. The idea that there was what I saw as a grave misunderstanding in the realm of politics about a lack of investment and a lack of concern or interest in basic communication.
Yes.
Everybody was just cribbing everyone else. And, you know, I used to take pictures in Austin of, you know, before election day, you'd see a median that was just full of 35 yard signs. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell one from the other, you know, yes, when they're all next to each other. And that seemed like it was by design. It seemed like fear was guiding,
yes,
the visual communications process. And that seemed like a shame. So now that people are talking about it,
yeah,
I would love to see it open the field. I would love to see more firms get involved.
Sure. It dovetails with our simple, fundamental editorial mission, which is to make people understand how much designers can and do reflect the society, but also shape the society. And the cliche that I always use, have used in my writing way too much, is the importance of design in commerce and culture. And the truth is, for most of my career, when I said commerce and culture, I meant mostly commerce, mm-hmm, because it was mostly business. But culture, the first wave was out into education, museums, the arts. And now I say commerce, culture, and causes, because that's really where the energy is now, and the political causes, social causes. It's exciting. So you mentioned Tandem. Let's jump to Tandem.
Sure.
So you're in Austin, and now you're in New York.
I was in Austin, and then one day I wasn't. It was something that I'd always known I needed to do, you know. It's easy to get comfortable somewhere, but the time was right, and I was past 30, and it was now or never, you know. So I moved to New York, and I was freelancing, and it was humbling. I learned a lot in those few months, and I'd done freelance before, but you know, I was relying on it as an income, which is a different way of living. Mm-hmm. It certainly is. But I moved here, and I had a friend from Kansas that had the great fortune, the rare fortune of having a backyard at the home he was living in. Mm. And so we were spending a lot of time. It was summer. We were just hanging out on his back porch, and he lived with my partner and the co-founder of Tandem, Sean Gillen. And we just started talking about design. And he was like, oh, I do what you do. And I feel like a lot of people, you know, say things like that. But as we were talking, we absolutely do, you know, do very similar things. The first night we really sat down and talked, we talked about how we should really put our heads together and use these skills that we'd learned over the course of our careers to really try to promote causes. And mm-hmm, if everybody that was an effective professional designer communicator spent a little more time, maybe, you know, the world could be a better place, which is kind of a trope, right? Kind of a cliche, and design can change the mm-hmm world. But, you know, what else is going to change the world if it's not thinking,
yeah,
deeply about, you know, the problems that face the world? And, you know, that conversation kind of never ended, as it were. He gave me the opportunity to begin working with him, with some of his clients. And we just went from there, and just, it's day by day, one foot in front of the other. And here we are today. Mm-hmm. We tried to take on as many causes along the way. We like to work with our friends. And in this case, one of our friends ended up becoming an international superstar.
So here's a question that may be too much of a cliche, but is New York still a magnet in your mind for young, talented, ambitious people who want to either personally or more broadly want to have an impact on the world?
You know, that is a cliche, but it's unfortunately, I think it's true. I hate to say it. I mean, a designer's never been more detached from a centralized location than now. You know, the democratization of technology's done fascinating things for the field. And I think you can succeed anywhere. That's fantastic. I know I personally wouldn't be having this conversation with you or anything like it with anyone, I don't believe, if I wouldn't have moved to New York. Mm-hmm. And I think New York's important for a couple of reasons. I think that there is a concentration of talent that's extremely important. You meet other talented people that are actually doing things. And it's kind of like that idea of the 5-minute mile in a way, mm-hmm. right? Like once you see that another human being can do something fascinating and exhilarating, you kind of can see it in yourself. And so meeting talented people, being around talented people really does have that effect on you, that it makes talent and extreme creativity real and palpable, tangible in a way. I also think the visual culture of New York City is so important. It's so important to my process, certainly. The idea of signage and it being so present in our lives. And if you look at New York and LA, I've always kind of thought that they have a very different culture. And I think a lot of that has to do with the concentration of people. It's so dense here that you have so little time and people aren't in their cars. And so you're communicating with them differently. And in LA, a lot of places might brand themselves. They might be a nail salon and they might call themselves Exhilarate or something. And you're like, what is that place? And you find out later that it's a nail salon when you actually peek your head in the door. There's this idea of exclusivity and trying to draw people in. And then in New York, when you walk down the street, you see a sign that just says coffee, you know, and it is very utilitarian. There's something about having a split second, knowing you have a split second and communicating to people in very different ways. And then there's the chance of being on the subway and seeing how people read their newspapers and how people look at magazines and what they look at on their cell phones. That has been so important to me. And then finally, it's meeting people. Meeting people in New York is so easy. You could be sitting in a bar or restaurant and find your next client. And I think that there is a culture of openness here. And New Yorkers can certainly be cold. They get a hard time sometimes, especially from tourists for being grumps. Maybe in the subway if you're gawking. that's how they treat you. But I really find that New Yorkers are open to all sorts of discussions and there's a directness here that leads pretty quickly past small talk into deeper conversations, which is how we met Alexandria. She was at Flats Fix, which is just a hole in the wall taco shop. I'd been missing tacos because I came from Austin, where you have tacos for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's where Sean and myself would go to have meetings and, mm-hmm. and talk things over, and Sandy would oftentimes, Alexandria would be behind the bar. Mm-hmm. And everybody in 2016 was talking politics. And so I don't recall exactly, you know, the first few conversations we had with her or, you know, how the friendship grew into talking on a more regular basis, but we ended up having a real friendship and a connection. She was interested in what we were doing with our firm and, you know, it was just a familial setting. Mm-hmm.
Was there one moment when she or you said, let's have a formal relationship and business relationship?
We were all just talking about how we can get more involved and be activated, how we can use the skills that we have to, you know, advocate for the things that we believe in. Sandy then went to Flint and Standing Rock after, you know, having that discussion. I'm sure she was having that discussion with a lot of people, as were we. And we lent her our GoPro, our studio's GoPro camera, if she needed it to document. And she did a lot of live streaming as she went on that trip. Shortly after that, she was nominated. A group called Brand New Congress reached out to her and suggested that she might run in New York's 14th district. And I remember talking to her about, Sean and I talked to her about whether she was going to do it or not. Mm-hmm. And we were, of course, excited. And the first thing we said was, you know, we're there. If you need our help, we're there to help you. So I'd say that was the first formal coalescing of the idea of a formal business relationship. But then the time between that and what it took to gear up the campaign was a pretty long stretch of time. And so in transition between her campaign really gearing up, I started volunteering my time with Brand New Congress and ultimately another group called Justice Democrats that's related to them. And then that turned into work for Tandem that came into the studio. And our young designers started working on projects as well. And we ultimately ended up designing the templates that were used for a multitude of candidates to help kind of fire up their grassroots campaigns from the very beginning. So we were really excited about that project. And then eventually one day, and she was still working at the bar at this time, she said, we've got the green light. We're ready to start working on the brand. So I started sketching right there and then.
So it's interesting to me. You've talked, I've read a little bit and you've talked about how you kind of stepped outside of the traditional political cliches when you were thinking about her design and messaging. And how did that happen? Or actually, you did mention that even in Austin, you were beginning to reject the constant red, white, and blue stripes. And
yeah. There's so many cliches in politics. I think there's reason to be risk adverse, except that the stakes are so high. So what I mean by that is standing out, it can be so detrimental to someone that if they think they have their endorsements in the right place and they think they have a constituency that they're appealing to, or maybe a single issue that might get them to the top of the ticket and get them elected, why would they risk that near certainty by getting wild with their visual communications? So they toe the line. But as progressives, as Democrats go, that's a seemingly conservative approach to communicating to the voters. At the same time, I think there's room for conservatives to also communicate personality, because ultimately politics is about policy to a degree, but at the same time, it's about trust and it's about community and it's about being comfortable with the people that are leading that community. So to be an automaton, as Edward Bernays would say in the book Propaganda, really also has a chance of alienating people. So everyone's so risk adverse that it actually, I think, turns in on itself. And that risk aversion ends up diminishing someone's chances of even catching someone's attention, mm-hmm. right? If they're not reading your message, then you've already lost the battle. That's the really long form way of saying that I started to develop a philosophy in Austin that especially progressives should take more chances and take more risks in trying to communicate with people and communicate honestly, not just to win, but because I honestly believe that's the right thing to do when it comes to visual communications, is to be as truly authentic as you possibly can. And so when it came time to consider what we do and how we approach Alexandria's campaign, we did understand the gravity of the challenge that she was up against. And then we also understood what it would mean if she were to win. Granted, we didn't know that it would capture the country's imagination the way that it had, but we did know that it would be a substantial media event. Mm-hmm. To clarify that, I had no idea anyone would want to talk to us about yes. graphic design after the fact,
yes.
but I knew that she would be on every newspaper in the country. So we weren't naive going into it. And that's why we looked towards populist movements of the past mm-hmm. and revolutionary movements. You know, there was an insurgent campaign going on. We didn't shy away from that. We thought that the idea of trying to sneak her under the radar as someone that was established and was part of, you know, politics as we know it, or the status quo, and you should vote for her because she has more experience than Joe Crowley, was never going to sell.
Yeah.
Right? And so if we went middle of the road, what were we doing? We were not communicating honestly, and we were missing a true opportunity to mm-hmm. tell the world what was going on here. And Sandy doesn't shy away from a fight, as we all know now. She's a firebrand. I mean, we thought about it, and we talked about it, and we considered it deeply, and we decided to just go for it. You know, we decided to accept and promote the idea that she was an insurgent revolutionary of sorts.
I know you've been asked about this frequently, but the color scheme, particularly unique and interesting.
Yeah.
Yellow and purple, prominent. Where did that come from?
Purple came from Brand New Congress. And the idea with Brand New Congress is that they were running insurgent campaigns against both Democrats and Republicans. I keep using the word insurgent, and that's kind of political insider speak. Challenging incumbents. So their idea was that this was just a healthy part of democracy, and that through their mission, the idea of red and blue coming together makes purple. So it's kind of a really basic but interesting color theory situation. And Alexandria herself really wanted to maintain that and really wanted to toe that line. So purple remained in the palette as a directive from Sandy. And then yellow was really kind of a moonshot on our behalf. The blue makes sense, right? We all see blue in most Democratic branding, but the yellow, which is really the third or the fourth color, I guess, if you consider white a color, in red, white, and blue, yellow is on all of our seals. It's in the beaks of most eagles, and it is really the tertiary color in the American color scheme. But that was a choice that Maria Reynas, our very talented young designer, started to play with. And the initial reaction for everyone was excitement and then immediate lack of confidence, in the sense that, is this too far? Have we gone too far? Have we stepped away from the codification of political branding too far in this one? And the first thing I noticed, which has actually been picked up on by some fantastic folks that have done critique of the design, the first thing we said in the office was, this looks like a Netflix poster promotion, right? Like, this looks like this really is kind of challenging the idea of political branding. All we have is the stars and the inverted exclamation marks. I'm a little averse to stars because, you know, of my past. I have some post-traumatic star stress from my days in politics in Austin, where that was always the joke among us was more stars, more stripes. Mm-hmm. The client wants another star on there, Scott. So we wanted to keep the stars minimal. And they were really there to represent Puerto Rico. and Sandy's heritage. And then when we threw the yellow on, it sang in that way that as designers, we all know when you hit a note and your concern or your lack of confidence is, can we sell this to the client? It's not, is this good? Is this right? Is this wrong? It felt good. It looked right. And so we did some deliberating, and what we came up with was, it is right. And we do want to encourage the campaign to use it. And the reason we think it's right is because of New York's 14th district, right? And in my experience in Texas, I don't think that I would have necessarily made this choice. We really have to look at how this will be used and how it'll be interacted with. And when you think about New York and you think about the density that's in New York's 14th district, that is a much smaller district than you're going to find in Wyoming, mm-hmm. which is a single district, right?
Right.
They don't even have enough people to fill out a district, right? So a poster would be least effective in Wyoming, where who's going to see it? But we're talking about a densely populated, one of the most densely populated and diverse districts. So A, we're competing with everything that's around. And if you've ever visited that part of the Bronx and Queens, it is a colorful area. You need to speak up if you want to be heard, because it is a vibrant community, full of color, full of sound. And when you look at the way a movie may advertise itself in the Midwest, for example, the advertisements look very different than they do on the subway platform. They take risks and they challenge people and they don't worry as much about offending people. And I think part of that is cutting through. You need to get attention, right? Whether you're a new Netflix series, new movie, or a new product, people see so many advertisements in densely populated parts of New York that you have to do something different or you're not going to get someone's attention. And so then that leads to a certain palette and a certain tolerance for things that challenge the status quo, if you will, or challenge common perception or common codification. So we really thought about it, and we thought about how important the posters were in that race versus others where they're not as important, right? Mm-hmm. Lena Hidalgo, we didn't make posters for her because Harris County is the third largest county in the United States. We weren't going to be able to print enough posters and have enough places for them to have that same impact, right? So we loved the yellow, to make a long story short. We loved the yellow and we told the campaign as much and they were a little uncertain about it, but they went ahead and printed all three anyway. And that's the beautiful thing about working with that campaign is that they trusted us through and through. And that is a very rare situation. Even the best designers will tell you, you know, even the most
seasoned. The logo bigger, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so what happened is they printed all three of those and the volunteers immediately started taking to the yellow, and it's the one that they wanted to put up. And it's the one that was getting taken down when they were putting them out in the public. You know, they'd put them on a light pole. They'd go back the next day and they'd be gone. Right. And that was a pretty good sign to everybody that was the poster that was resonating.
So beyond posters, what other elements were in the campaign that were important?
Her website was obviously very important. Communications hub. Alexandria did all of her own social media as far as writing goes. And so I would really say we played a supplementary role in just helping her promote her fantastic use of social media. And I think when historians take to this race, I think that's something that they'll absolutely latch on to, is how accessible she was in her use of social media. But at the end of the day, when someone goes to donate, you know, and someone goes to learn about the issues, they end up at the website. And so that was a vital piece of the campaign. And then the walk card that they used to go door knocking was also vital. And, you know, I went to a parade. I went to the Pride Parade to just volunteer to be there. And it was kind of fun though. It was fun to see how it was such a grassroots campaign, how people were really taking to it and making it their own. So, you know, how they used those pieces and getting to see that was important. You know, I'd say the t-shirts were an important part of the campaign, but you know, we did all of the communications materials. So I would love to hear, you know, in a postmortem with the campaign, which I'll have here in a few weeks, what were huge successes? And Maria, and I brought her up earlier, the lead designer, just really worked through all those details painstakingly with the campaign. And we work as a team, but I really have to give her credit for grinding out all the, you know, sure. If they wanted a business card,
the applications, the campaign,
yeah. And they, you know, like all clients, they want a letter size page worth of copy on a business card and the process of trying to make that as close to feasible as possible, that fell on Maria, and she did a fantastic job with that.
Do people still do political buttons?
We do political buttons. Yes, there were political buttons for the Ocasio campaign. And the other night at her watch party, we saw a lot of buttons. And then there was what has become kind of a fairly new phenomenon in politics. There were people that made their own buttons. There were people that made their own t-shirts. And there really is a DIY component to so many campaigns. And we have some friends at Wide Eye Creative that did Bernie Sanders' identity. And they talk about this. They talk about they worked on the Stacey Abrams campaign as well. They talk about how it's really something you have to expect at this point. You know, I think we saw it with Barack Obama in a big way, and we saw it again with Hillary. We saw it with Trump as well. The creation of memes, the idea that people will make their own bumper stickers or their own yard signs, it is just a matter of fact now. And I really believe that has a lot to do with the democratization of mm-hmm. desktop publishing. You know, it's so accessible to people now. For those of us that were developing websites as they came into being and then saw the transition from HTML to CSS to responsive web design, it is a different way of approaching problem solving. It's a different way. You have to think about variable content, but now you kind of have to think about variable use cases, right? As a designer, you usually have control because you have the output and then you have a certain expectation for who your user base will be. And you know, if you're lucky, can analyze that, quantify that, get data. But when you put something out there that really people take hold of it in the world, you can't really plan for what they're going to do with it, except you can plan that you can't plan for what they're going to do with it.
That's great. Back to Tandem for a moment. When you think of, I don't know how you articulate what it is your mission is, but let's say designing for good, socially responsible design, however you want to think about it. Do you see it as taking shape as a mostly or all political candidate clients, or are you working with companies and associations and foundations on causes as well?
Definitely working with causes. The consensus in Tandem, I think I am a policy wonk when it comes down to it. It stirs something in me that I don't think everyone is as politically driven as me in the studio. Everyone's aware, you know, and Sean is also interested in politics. I really thrive on it, live and breathe it. But it's important for the studio to not be boxed in. And we all listen to one another and we all speak up when it comes to the future of Tandem. And you know what? I can go work on political campaigns individually, or I do some side consulting, you know, for free, or talk through things with people, not always for free, but, you know, if it's somebody that just needs help, I can go do that on my own. But as a group of individuals, I think our mission is like you said, to do good. And it's to use the tenets of advertising and marketing, which are usually used to promote consumption and commercialization, to promote good and to promote civic engagement or even humanistic causes. And so we worked recently with Planned Parenthood. We've been talking to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation about a potential project. We've been talking to a number of causes. And I think that's the future of our company. I think that's the future of Tandem. I think everyone feels good about working with people that are trying to provide healthcare to individuals or, you know, trying to raise the quality of life, you know, and not everything's a battle. You know, we should be able to reach consensus on some of these things. And so we want to put our skills behind those causes as well. And it also doesn't run on a cycle. it's complicated in politics because one minute you have more work than can possibly be done. And then the next minute everything shuts down. I guess that's becoming less and less the case because we were talking about 2020 and 2016. Right. But
the campaign's already begun.
Right. But yeah, that's from an administrative point of view. But I'm just joking. I think it is our mission and it aligns with our mission, the idea of promoting causes. And I think that's the trend. I think that's more and more what we're seeing young people be interested in. We get correspondence from all sorts of people all over the country saying they just want to help. You know, how can they get involved with what we're doing? And generally when they say what they're interested in being involved in, they don't say politics, you know, they say advocacy, they say things that matter. They say, I want to do something that, that helps. Right. And so those basic ideas, I think, are the future of design. I think people should promote good design in commerce and consumption. I think it'll help us put into perspective what's good consumption, what's bad consumption. It'll help us make better choices when we buy things, help us buy things that last. But at the same time, promoting intangible ideas is the future of design.
I can't think of a better way to finish. I mean, interesting, inspiring. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much. This has been an honor.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. You can listen and download the GDUSA podcast anywhere podcasts are available. The next print edition of our magazine, the January-February 2019 issue, will be available during the first week of February. Visit us online at www.gdusa.com. Again, thanks for listening.